He kōna e ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
No mai, haere mai, it's good to have your company today for Country Life. I'm Carol Stiles.
And I'm Duncan Smith. Kia ora. Today we're meeting a farmer who didn't get mains power to his farm until 1968. Farming was tough then, and it's still a challenge today.
We're out checking a few beehives in Canterbury.
And we hear about a new blueberry grower on the block. It's partnering with Māori entities to increase production on their land and to create jobs for locals.
But first to our look around the country. Farmers in Northland are breathing a slight sigh of relief after good rain this week helped ease dry conditions. Kaitaia received about 150 millimetres and down the way in Whangarei they got about 120. The farmer we spoke to says it's saved the season. However, good follow-up rain is needed in the coming weeks to ensure the rain doesn't go to waste. 30 millimetres of rainfall on Monday was very welcome on the very dry soils around Pukekohe. Some strong wind was only of minor inconvenience. From midweek onwards, days were dry, bright and sunny with irrigation systems turned on. Crown pumpkins are maturing and should be arriving at retailers soon.
Some parts of Waikato copped the rain better than others this week. 10 to 25 millimetres in central areas and up to 40 millimetres in the north of the region. But then the wind came through. Hey, but it's summer. Maize crops are being harvested and pregnancy testing's underway. And our contact says the latest average was 16% empty cows, slightly up on last year. There's uncertainty why. A farmer in King Country had 40 millimetres of rain this week, which ended with beautiful fine weather. Tupping has started. A few rams have gone out. While the weather and feed levels have been fine, farmers are feeling the pinch of lower cattle and lamb prices this year.
That hoped-for rain arrived in Bay of Plenty too this week. A farmer in the west was very pleased with his 80 millimetres and some guys further inland got 140. It's soaked in and the grass is already turning from brown to green. But some of the rotting grass is prime breeding territory for facial eczema spores. A winemaker in Gisborne has set up pods on his vineyard to house workers arriving for busy times ahead. The lack of housing for harvest workers has been a worry. They've now managed to get a full crew for the harvest, including half a dozen foreigners already in the country. Our contact's particularly excited to be employing a lot of young local people this season. The grapes are about 10 days ahead of normal and picking should start on March the 2nd.
Hawke's Bay had about 35 millimetres odd of rain this week, but the warmth straight afterwards meant the rain didn't have much effect. The three-day lockdown in Auckland had an impact on the week's sales, similar to a long weekend. Buyers don't buy as much produce because they don't think they can sell as much. However, the independent retailers were still buying. The apple harvest is now well and truly underway, and students' return to uni is causing some anxiety among growers. They're wondering who will pick the fruit for the next month or so. The farmer we spoke to in Taranaki says out of his 5 years share milking in the region, this season is by far the best. The milk payout rose to its highest level in nearly 7 years this week, and farmers were stoked. On the farm, grass is bolting out of the ground. Farmers say it's not often a good grass-growing season lines up with a strong payout.
Our contact in Manawatū Rangitike says good rain this week means all of a sudden people can start making some decisions as they've been in a bit of a holding pattern. Lambs will start growing again and land can be put into crops. The seed rep's been around this week to talk about regrassing for winter. Another draft of lambs is off to the works and a nice spell of weather now means some R&M like gorse spraying can take place. Chilling space has been filling up at processing plants because of shipping hold-ups. An arable farmer in Wairarapa is in the thick of harvest with barley underway at the moment. Peas and ryegrass are already in. They were held up a couple of days by the rain this week, which brought 35 millimetres to their farm. Out on the coast, farmers were chuffed to receive 70 millimetres. Our contact has been busy raising awareness about safety on farms. She says wearing a seatbelt on farm would make such a difference to farm fatality rates.
And across the water to Te Waipanamu, where fruit harvesting's underway in the Nelson Motueka region. Royal Gala apples are coming off, and a grower near Richmond says he's picking Taylor's Gold, Peckham and Nashi pears. The fruit quality's fine, but a couple of heavy frosts last October has resulted in some surface damage. He says 55% of the district's total pear crop was destroyed by the Boxing Day hailstorm. Staffing's still an issue, with signs on road seeking seasonal workers. Marlborough's high country is dry, but our contact at the top of the Waihopai Valley says it's been a good year for growth. The merinos are coming down soon for weaning and crutching. He says when he is young, he'd have to walk up and get them, as the land that goes up to 1,500 metres is too steep for horses. Now, a ute can get to the top of the station, so all the shepherds have to do is walk the sheep down with their dogs. How times have changed. He says he's also using some lower land to diversify into deer, so this week the high fences have been going in.
A farmer at Whatteroa on the west coast says there's been no rain for 10 days. It's forecast for next Wednesday, so her fingers are crossed that it arrives. The annual rainfall there is about 5 metres, but dry periods like this are not unusual during late summer. She says the cows are on summer turnips and grass and milk levels are above average. Pregnancy scanning's underway and the first cut of silage is wrapped and ready for winter. In Canterbury, after a nice rain at the start of the week, the season seems to have changed and it feels very autumnal, especially first thing in the mornings. This has slowed harvest up and it's currently limited to mid to late afternoons. Grass growth is good where there is irrigation. Coastal Canterbury remains dry. The North Canterbury deer farmer we spoke to says the stags are just starting to roar, which is about a month early. The deer on the farm are in good condition and next week the fawns will be weaned off their mothers. Down the road in South Canterbury, farmers have woken up to 2 frosts this week. Far too cold for February, but a sign autumn is on the way.
The peach and nectarine harvest in central Otago is still running a week to 10 days ahead of normal. There's been enough labour to pick the fruit. The weather's been great for harvesting and the growers are hoping the overlap they've had with Hawke's Bay fruit will now ease off and prices can creep up for them a little. In Southland, people have been top-dressing to keep grass going. Winter crops are doing okay, and even though it's not overly dry, a farmer near Invercargill says he's surprised at how some paddocks cut for baleage are slow to respond. His cows are on a 16-hour-a-day milking regime and production levels are holding up well. Across the board, farmers are very pleased with news of a payout increase. This is likely to help reduce debt and pay for environmental changes on farm.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National, 101 FM.
The Northern Coromandel Peninsula is just 60 kilometres from downtown Auckland as the crow flies. However, few roads are sealed. The hills are still bush-clad and some services have been very slow to reach it. Very few people call it home. Colville farmer Les Ward is one of them. His grandfather arrived in the area in the late 1890s, wanting a better life, and the peninsula is still dotted with his descendants. Les told me conditions were pretty grim in England when his grandfather left, but he and his grandmother wouldn't have known what they were coming to.
I'm sure they probably didn't, because it was very tough when they got here.
What was the landscape like then?
Oh, it was pretty much totally bush. Right down to the water, which they cleared. It was all manual axes. And there was no power machinery at all in those days.
Very early on, Les's grandfather farmed a few sheep and cattle.
They sold firewood. The manuka and kānuka they were clearing was ideal firewood for the Auckland market, so they cashed in a bit on that.
There were 7 brothers?
Yes, in my father's family.
Were there girls?
1 girl. They all started up the coast here. And most of them ended up being on the farming side of it. One of them went fishing up the Bay of Islands. Another one ran a scow from Auckland, serving the coastline around the peninsula.
Do you know what sort of things he carted?
Oh, all sorts. Timber, granite, livestock. Mm. I remember when I was really young, mother and father, they'd order the stores from the Farmers Trading Company in Auckland, and they'd come across. We'd go along to the wharf, pick up drums of kerosene and all the other stores, bulk flour and sugar and all those sort of things.
Les and his twin brother went to the local school and then to Auckland for high school. They left as soon as they could.
Didn't like the place. Neither my brother or I, we couldn't stand it. came back here because I just wanted to carry on the land here. Didn't like the city. Never have done.
What about your mum? Where did she come from?
She came from Gisborne initially, but unfortunately her first husband got killed during the Second World War. And when my father came back from 1945, he came back and he worked in Auckland until he found someone to marry. And he happened to find my mother. She had lost her husband and had two daughters. And somehow he coaxed her to come to Colville.
She wasn't very impressed when she arrived.
It was very isolated, no services, no power, very limited everything.
It's probably a good thing that he stayed in Auckland until he found a partner, because the population must have been quite low.
That's right. She adapted very well once she got here and settled. She got into things like Women's Division and those rural ladies' groups, but she couldn't drive for years. And she was probably 40 or 45 before she got a licence to drive and had a vehicle to drive.
Living without electricity, that must have been...
Yes, now that was the hardest part, I think, having a range to cook on. Kerosene fridge. The old man had a little lighting plant just for our lights at night. He'd put a bit of petrol in the thing, and when the petrol ran out, the lights went out. That was about me, Tom. But the meat was mostly mutton. Could you kill a sheep, you could pretty well handle that. But you couldn't kill a beast. There's no way of keeping it. It just didn't happen. The kerosene fridge was the biggest problem because it used to go out and you had to fiddle with it all the time, fiddle with the wick to keep it burning right.
What years are we talking here? We're talking the 50s?
Yes, 50s and early 60s.
When did you get electricity?
I think it was around 68, the mains power came in here. And that was the greatest thing because we got a deep freeze and we got a fridge.
That was 80 years after electricity flowed in Reefton, the first New Zealand town to have a public power supply. When Les was a child, the family's main income came from their 45 dairy cows.
We separated the milk. The cream went out initially to Pyrrol, and we fed pigs on the whey or the skim. But then the Pyrrol factory shut down, and the last place the cream went to was Tuakau. When they didn't want it anymore, we had to sell the milking cows about 1985, and we went to dry stock.
Well, that would have been quite a change, I would imagine.
Well, yeah, it was quite good, actually. We didn't have to get up so early.
Pine trees provided another income stream.
The old man had started planting trees in 1947, pine trees.
Gosh, what made him do that?
He valued the use of all the land, using all the land. And there was terrible erosion problem here with these back hills, steep hills. So there was a guy over the other side, on the eastern side of the peninsula, started planting pine trees. And somehow my father heard about this. And then they decided they were going to plant the back steep hills here. So he started in 1947.
In the scheme of things, was that pretty early for pine tree plantations in New Zealand?
They were planting pine trees down the middle of the North Island before that, but for up here, that everybody thought he was cracked. But anyway, when we left school, we had all these 20-year-old pine trees ready for thinning, and there wasn't any posts available, fence posts. So we started cutting these posts and treating them with creosote on the property here and selling them to the neighbours.
Les and his brother started a mill, and they've been milling timber, treating it and selling it for 50 years. They also set up a piggery, buying a neighbour's milk, and between the timber business and the piggery, they're able to save enough money to buy two nearby farms. There are a few properties with better land in the district, but Les says generally it's hard country.
There's not very much fattening goes on up here. It's not too bad for breeding cattle, but to finish your cattle up here, the grass isn't good enough. So I sell my weaners and people come and buy them, take them away or do what they like.
Cattle from farms further up the peninsula used to be driven to sales, sometimes as far away as Thames, but now carting them out is a job for experienced truck drivers.
The trucking from right up the top can be hazardous.
Well, the road really only has... It's only wide enough for a car.
It's all gravel and very narrow and steep. And the trucking firm that does all the regular driving up here, they send up drivers that know the road, done it all before dozens of times. They very rarely send a new driver up here. My nephew, right up the top, he quite often drives in front of the truck just to warn oncoming vehicles, because the road is just not wide enough to pass a truck and trailer in many, well, most of the places.
Because the land is quite poor up here for feeding stock, can the farmers make a dollar out of it?
It's getting harder, and we're losing farms. We're losing farm after farm up here. The original farmers are getting old and dying off, and the younger generation just don't want to do it. So the farms are getting cut up and sold, and we're getting less and less farms, operational farms, up here all the time. Dramatically so.
Do you have to put a lot of fertiliser on?
I don't personally, only because I haven't got anybody to carry on when I've finished here. And I can't see a lot of sense in putting a lot of money back into it, knowing that later on this is probably have to be sold. I just haven't got a family member that's willing or able to continue what I've been doing.
And what about your mum? Did she stay here right to the end, or did she...
No, she actually moved to Thames. I think her heart was always here.
What about your dad?
Well, he unfortunately had a heart attack and dropped dead doing his normal day's work. But he never wanted to go anywhere. He lived his whole life here, and he was happy here with his brothers. I think they enjoyed themselves up here. They didn't want to go to the city or do anything rather than what they were doing. And the next generation, like ourselves and my cousins, they're just following on what their fathers did. But anyway, it hasn't worked out too bad. It's been a pretty useful sort of a life.
Les Ward from Colville. Les says the reason their sawmill has survived and lots haven't is that they're milling their own trees and treating the timber on site so the timber doesn't have to be transported. He says it also helps that it's a family business with family on the payroll. And Les also makes beautiful, fine furniture. He says he loves working with wood, whether it's crafting a dining suite or chopping firewood.
Now on Country Life, we're buzzing down to Kirwee in mid-Canterbury with Cosmo Kentish Barnes. He's with Glenn Cleaver from Kirwee Bees, who's inspecting some hives that have been out on local farms.
You see the pollen on the legs as they fly in. This one here's got a dusting all over it. They're building up ready for winter, so plenty of pollen coming in, sets them up nicely.
How has the season been?
It's been really changeable. I mean, I don't think you ever get a beekeeper that's going to say they're over the moon with their season or complain about something, but with the rain that we've had here this season, it's been very changeable when the temperature's up and down. Clover flow's been quite a lot lower in the Canterbury area. North Island has had a really bad season with the Manuka, but hives are looking really good, so that's all that matters.
Will the weather conditions impact on the amounts of honey you can produce?
Yeah, I'm down quite a bit on the amount of honey that we're bringing in this season. But like I was saying before, the hives are in really, really good condition. So that sets us up well for next year. You're always going to be an optimist if you're a beekeeper.
The bees are swarming around us, but they're not too bothered by us.
Using the word swarming around bees, we say they're flying. Swarming is a bit of a dark word to use. But we're right in the middle of the flight path, so think of Heathrow Airport, they're all trying to get in to land.
Now, you were saying that you were out in the middle of the night collecting hives.
Yeah. Pollination contracts had finished on one farm, so we shift them all at night so they're at home and it's nice and cool, so it's easy for me to work on. So setting them all up ready for winter.
How important is that sort of work for your business?
The pollination work is massive for us as the price of honey has dropped and there's quite a lot of competition. There's a lot of people trying to sell honey in New Zealand. So trying to keep the bees alive and keep ourselves fed, the pollination work does go a long way to pay for that, and it's really important here in Canterbury. A lot of seed is growing for the overseas market, so good healthy hives are important for that.
What sort of crops would you normally pollinate?
We do a lot of the Asian greens, so bok choy, tetsoi, there's mustard greens. There is a lot of radish grown in Canterbury, all for seed, and also carrot. But we also do a lot of things like different varieties of clover to go on the dairy farms, so they need it to be for seed. So we do a heck of a lot of clover seed.
Because, as you've mentioned, there's quite a lot of competition, is it quite hard to find new farms to take your hives to?
Yes, it is. We're always looking for new areas to put the hives on. We beekeeper a wee bit different, and I treat my hives organically. We don't claim our honey to be organic or anything because the bees fly 3 km from the hive, but the way I manage the hives is a wee bit different, so we're in them quite often, so having farms that we can come and go on is really important, and we look after the farmers as well, like if there's stock there that need attention and that, you know, we like to keep a good relationship, it's important.
How many hives would a farm, you know, a reasonably sized cropping farm normally use?
Depends on the crop. So radish can be up to 4 hives per hectare. For certain varieties can be sometimes more. Clover is a lot less because the bees are more attractive to it. Carrot is hard work to get them to pollinate. So it depends on the crop. But it's, you know, a lot of our cropping, like our radish and that, we can't sell out that honey because of the flavour of it. I haven't found a market for radish-flavoured honey yet. So.
So what do you do with that honey?
One of our main things is we breed queens. So I need to have a really early start on the season with my hives. Having a good source of tucker on all the good hives I want to breed from is quite handy for me.
So the honey that the bees produce from pollinating stays in the hives and feeds them over the winter period?
Yeah, it sets them up. And I can't see the idea of taking all the honey off and then feeding them back sugar. It's like feeding a kid on McDonald's. They'll survive, but they won't do well on it.
Why do you breed the queens?
There's a big demand now for Italians and calm, less aggressive bees for guys chasing manuka. It's not worthwhile them having a queen raiser and spending time making queens when they can all be out chasing the white stuff. You got one that's a headhunter.
Headhunter, no!
Glenn, why and how did you first start a honey business?
I didn't really have a choice. I was surrounded by bees at a young age and had some a family of beekeepers as well. So it's something that's always really interested me. And our history, we were the first people to bring the Italian bees into New Zealand in the 1800s, generations ago, so I guess I was doomed to be a beekeeper.
And your entire family's involved?
We don't really have, they don't have a choice. Nan, who's hiding, probably looking out the window watching us, she's 84, she takes all my notes and keeps me on the straight and narrow. My brother-in-law helps do all the heavy lifting for me. And my wife makes body products and bits and pieces with the wax and honey, and right down to the kids that operate gates and help me with the hives on the school holidays. So it's necessary.
Mm. And you've got a shop here on the property?
Yeah, well, we go from hive to jar, so we do everything ourselves. And we can trace each jar of honey back to a hive in a area. So
that's a nice touch.
It's, you know, we're not big. We're only little guys, but we try and squeeze as much as we can out of everything.
And Glenn, where are things at now with the varroa mite?
So I mentioned earlier that I treat organically for our hives. I was lucky enough to do some trials on a organic treatment made overseas, and we're trying to get it approved for MPI. It's still an ongoing process. Things take a long time. But in the meantime, we Kiwis have worked out how to make it. And I've been using that for the last 10 years.
What do you do?
Ozone oxalic acid, so it's a naturally occurring acid. if I don't get it right, my hives die and I affect other people. So I talk a lot about organic treating of the hives, so I've got to make sure what I'm doing is working. So there's a lot more management in the hives with the varroa, but it comes with some benefits. It's killed off a lot of hives that were in the wild that may have had AFB, American foul brood, and when the wax moth cleans up the wax and the residue in the hive, it helps lower those risks. But on the opposite, we've got increase in commercial hives and domestic hives, which increases the risk. So that's all trying to find that balance.
Mm. I'm surprised that the varroa mites didn't put off some people from getting into the industry.
I think the money side of things with the Manuka and the craze, it was almost like a gold rush where people could make a fortune off, you know, 30, 50 hives. With the changing of the definition of Manuka through MPI, that's certainly changed a lot, and there's a lot of people that have banked on huge amounts of money per kilo for their honey and are now only getting $5 if they're lucky.
So did MPI set a standard?
Yes. Otherwise it was probably going to end up where we would struggle to export our honey. Same with our disease control and what we do. We need to have proof to our export partners that we are doing what we say we're doing. But it's, you know, the standard that we have in New Zealand doesn't apply to New Zealand. So unfortunately, people that were selling off stuff that was substandard are now flogging it off to New Zealanders. So we have a very high standard for our export honey, but people can still call other honeys Manuka.
Do you think that should be changed, that rule?
I believe so. I'll get shot down by other beekeepers that say this. But a lot of honey is bought here in New Zealand and then shipped privately overseas. Some of that in quite large numbers. So they're sending it back over to the family. And if you're buying honey and it's not what it says on the label, you're not doing us any favours.
And do you produce Manuka honey?
I produce a little bit. There's bees busy in there. There we go, girls.
Right, now, just for your listening pleasure, Glenn has lifted the lid up on one of the hives and has put one of my microphones in.
This is when you drop the lid. You know, with a face that looks like a pizza.
Thank you for that. You've come out unscathed.
Sound of bees busy doing their job.
And so what's on the agenda for the rest of the day?
I've got a heap of virgin queens to put out that have just hatched in the incubator. I'm really passionate about raising good queens, so we go out and put them out, and hopefully in 3 weeks, 4 weeks' time, we'll have a nice new hive ready to go.
That was Glenn Cleaver from Kiwi Bees.
Hi, I'm Robin Howe of Remarkable Valets, the cutest sheep in the world, and you're listening to Country Life, RNZ National.
Time now for this week's feature story. Carol's taking us now to hear about a start-up company that in just 3 years has become New Zealand's largest tunnel house blueberry grower.
How many blueberry bushes, Liz?
40,000.
40,000? Wow.
Tēnā koe, Carol. Tēnei te mihi kia koe. Nau mai, haere mai, ki te whare o Miro. I raro I te maru o Putoaki Maunga, tatanea ki Rangatai ki Awa, ko Ngāti Awa, te tangata whenua o tēnei rohe.
I'm here on a busy orchard at Te Teko near Whakatane with Liz Tiamo. Liz is the chief executive of Miro, a collective of Māori food producers, all with the goal of lifting food production on Māori land and creating jobs for whānau. On this orchard, 20 hectares of blueberries are flourishing. They're being grown under polytunnels and pots on Mehana Kawata Trust land.
And we have partnered with them for 2 years now to build this orchard. So they are 50% owners in this orchard. And they bought into Middle's vision of transforming their land and their people through high-value horticulture. So that's really the vision that we have for middle, we have 30 shareholders. They're all iwi, hapu, landowners, Māori entities from around around New Zealand.
So this is just
starting
the start.
With blueberries.
Yes.
Starting with blueberries. And so at a high level, the company Middle was only established in the middle of 2017. And as we sort of stand here today at the end of 2020, we've got 12 orchards under development or growing 50 hectares of blueberries across the North Island. We start right up the top in Hauhora with Ngāti Kuri, come down to Ngāti Hauā in Morrinsville, out to Tauranga Moana on Matakana Island, here in Te Tiko are the biggest orchards that we have, about 25 hectares in total, down to Gisborne, Wepere Trust, up to Tolaga Bay with Ngāti Porou and Hauiti, down to Bulls, Ngāti Apa and Ati Hau Whanganui, and then out to Taranaki, Ngāti Ruanui and South Taranaki has 6 hectares under development. So in the space of 2 years, you know, Māori have invested upwards of $20 million in this venture, and thanks to the government, particularly the Provincial Growth Fund, they've been able to borrow capital to make that dream come true.
Liz says Miro started with blueberries because the world loves them.
So you don't have to sell the health and wellness benefits of blueberries to the world, and particularly in this COVID year, globally we've seen an absolute surge in the popularity of blueberries, both fresh and frozen. We looked for good varieties, and the blueberries that we grow here under the brand Eureka come from Australia, and they're big and sweet and juicy, and consumers love them.
This particular variety we grow undercover to keep the rain off, to keep the birds out.
Ryan Donovan is Murrell's horticulture production manager.
It's a big variety. That's why the consumers love it. It's tasty, crunchy, and it gets going early in the spring from about October onwards.
2 years ago, about half the blueberries grown on this orchard were exported, but for the season just finished, it'll probably be a little less than that.
One of the big challenges of a COVID year is air freight went from $1.05 a kilo to $4.05 a kilo almost overnight. So that's been very tough on exporters of fresh produce this year, which has meant a lot more flowing into the domestic market.
Should we go and have a bit of a walk?
Yeah. We have a core team member. So this is Tamati Kepedātahi, and Tamati can tell us how long he's been here, where he's from, and what's he learned since he's been here.
Kia ora, my name's Tamati Kepedātahi. I've been at Middle for 3 years now.
So you must have been one of the first staff members.
Yeah, one of them. Was based in Whakatane. Some of my whānau's got shares in this land. Learned a lot coming here, Middle. Learned a lot about plants. See a lot of our good Māori community coming together and working. It's so good to see a lot of employment in Te Tiko. So when I first started at this job, I started putting drippers in, doing the irrigation, putting tunnels up, tightening ropes, and doing plastics also.
And what are you doing now?
Do everything really, do construction, build this whole site, do the data fill over here, weigh our fruit and the chiller.
And what's next for you? What would you like to do?
Like to hopefully build one of these orchards on my land in Whakatane and hopefully employ all our Whakatane ones back home.
Is that sort of thing that is a possibility, Liz?
So Tamati's whānau is a shareholder, one of the 30 shareholders of Middle, and what you grow on your land has a lot to do with whether or not you have water and what your land's suitable for. So they'd be welcome to have a go at berries. I think it's a water. Oh, there's a water challenge on their land, and that's one of the things actually that we help our landowners with, and it's a plight Māori have got stuck in. So Tamati's whānau is a real case of, for years they have just been friendly neighbours and approved the water consents for all the non-Māori orchards around them, and so when they find they're ready to go and build over their own land, they find there's no water and they can't get water consents. So that's the biggest thing that's holding that whānau back, and holds many whānau back, is they've been good neighbours but they've given away all the water consents, and now council says to them there's no more water for you, sorry. But we're happy to walk alongside those land trusts and work with council and say, well, let's really dig into whether or not there is water available here, whether there's unused consents, where people have got them but not using it, and if Māori land and Māori people offer the greatest potential this country has in some ways, then let's really lean into that and help them.
At Te Tepo, state-of-the-art technology carefully allocates water.
In here is the, I guess you'd call it the lifeline of the orchard. It's the irrigation shed. So this system's smart enough to know exactly when the plant needs a drink or when it needs some food. It is measuring the sun and the transpiration and reacts. So unlike a traditional irrigation system out in the older orchards where you manually will turn it on when you think the plants are dry and you traditionally apply fertiliser when you think they need some food, this does it for you. So it takes into consideration how hot the day is and will automatically turn on the irrigation system and send out some fertiliser as needed in the irrigation system, hence why we call it a fertigation system. No wasted, you're not flooding the ground, there's no fertiliser running off into the water table, it's just precision horticulture.
Just before harvest, a new cool store was built.
So with blueberries, it's critical to get the field heat out of them as soon as possible. So they can be in excess of 20 degrees, maybe 25 degrees out in the field. We need to get them down to around 6 degrees as soon as we can, preferably within a couple of hours from the time that we pick them. So they come in to the cool store from the field within 15 minutes of picking. We take them into here.
It's nice and cool.
And with some really smart cooling these days, we literally force the air through and pull it back to take out the heat, snap them down to 6 degrees before we send them on the truck to the cool store.
Hello.
Another victim. This is Ebony.
Hello, Ebony. How are you?
So, Ebony, what's your job here?
I'm the buggy driver.
Before you got this job, what were you doing?
I was working with native plants and doing cuttings and dispatching plants off to other orchards and stuff like that.
Yeah. And how's this job?
Oh, I love it. I love being outdoors. I love blueberries.
And you're local?
Yes, I am local. I live in Te Tiko. This place is the best thing that's happened to Te Tiko, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, because what was happening in Te Tiko before?
There wasn't much employment. Hard to get a job around here for the unemployed people, and this place really works around like young mums. You know, it works around their time schedules with their kids going to school and stuff. Meadow was really good like that.
Ebony was saying that you have sort of flexible working hours for young mums.
We try to, particularly during harvest, because our kaupapa is to employ local, and we're really proud that we've got over 93% local Māori on our staff. I think last week, as it was our biggest payroll ever, we had 157 people. And those are jobs that just wouldn't be there if Metal wasn't here. So to be able to bring that kind of employment, income into households, income into whānau in these very poor rural communities, that's what transformation looks like to us, and being true to our kaupapa of employing our own.
So you're hoping this model will be replicated throughout New Zealand and all those other places you were speaking of?
Well, we only grow with our shareholders, so we only grow with our Māori shareholders and landowners, and they have the same driving kaupapa of we're here to lift productivity on Māori land and employ our own people.
Liz says the shareholders are also very interested in Merrill owning its own intellectual property.
And so we have projects around, you know, what's the next kiwi fruit going to look like, or let's find a crop that we can have ownership of. They were also interested in having a global Māori brand, one that reflected who we are as a people. So those are more sort of Horizon 2, Horizon 3 projects for us. Today it's about building orchards, standing up the jobs and supporting our communities to, I guess you'd call it our version of economic rangatiratanga, just self-determination. Yeah, and we love it. We love we can get three generations working on this orchard. You'll come and meet Ivy. She's got her right down to her grandchildren working here, and that's a beautiful thing.
Auntie! Auntie! Come on, let's go for a walk down there.
Okay.
I'll dive under here. Cool.
Taste them. Try them, pull them off. They're beautiful.
Fantastic.
Kia ora, auntie.
Morena. Hello.
Can we turn the music on, please, guys?
Turn the musical.
So this is Ivy Habib. She's one of our top supervising nannies, aunties, mothers in the field. And so she's a lot of whānau here, but she's just one of our best supervisors on the paddock.
Hello, Ivy.
Hi.
Hello. So you've got lots of family working here.
Yes, my daughter, who's the top picker, and my grandsons.
So are you from Te Tika?
No, I'm from Waiohau, Merupara. I am from Te Tika. My parents come from Mapo.
And then what, you heard about this?
Oh, my trust is invested in it. So when the AGM came up, I came in with the other trustees and I just asked out of the blue, oh, do you guys have jobs for other people, like the trustees? And all that? And they go, yes, we actually want you to come in and bring your family. So, yeah, here we are with my family and my daughter, my grandchildren and all my other cousins and aunties. Got a few here now.
Must be lovely coming to work and being surrounded by people that you love and know.
Yes, yes it is. Yeah, everyone going, hi, morning. You know, it's a boost for your morale, for the people that some are sad, but, you know, when they hear that, ooh, hey, time to work.
And what's Miro like to work for?
They're good people, really good people, especially our CEO and her new manager, Ryan. He's pretty good. He's just getting to learn how Māori's are in business, I suppose. I don't know. But he's a really good fella. She's a really good CEO. She gets out in the field with us now and then. And it gives the pickers a bit of a boost when they see the top boss in there with them, sweating with them. She doesn't like me to say that, but she's a lovely boss.
So what is your job here, Ivy?
I supervise and help teach the new pickers how to pick.
Yeah.
And what to pick and how to put it into their totes, because there's a certain way you pick these and you don't just throw them in or drop them in, you place them in nicely so they're not bruised or anything. Keep the bloom.
Yeah, I've heard that's really important. It's that sort of dull coating.
Yes, that powdery look, when we keep that on there, we try to pick as nicely as we can.
That's huge. Can I try that one?
Of course you can. They're beautiful.
What's the biggest one you've ever picked?
It's like that big. It's way bigger than a $2 coin. Yeah, and a big, the old 50 cent coin. But yeah, that's the biggest. They're like little pumpkins. That's what we call them, little pumpkins.
Good morning.
Now, I was just wondering how much in weight you might pick in a day.
Oh, on a good day, like if it's like packed like this, I can get up to like 70
kilos.
70 kgs, yeah.
Of blueberries?
Yep. Yeah. But if it's like hot by lunchtime, just maybe under 60.
What makes the difference? Like, too hot and you got to knock off?
Yeah, because the berries, you can't pick them at a certain heat, right, in a certain time of day. They like wilt to you and they soften up the plant, so you kind of know when to stop.
And what were you doing before you did this job?
Being a mum. Being a mum, I've got number 7 in my puku at the moment. Unexpected. It wasn't planned.
That's more like it.
Yeah, it wasn't planned, so. But I still love picking. I love money, so. Got to get out there and work if you love money, eh? We get here every morning at 5:30 and leave whenever we're knock off is. So on a day, on like a cloudy air's day, a cool day, we finish about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so by the time we get home, we're tired.
I bet you are.
Yep. 4 o'clock every morning, we're up, shower, get our lunch ready, and then come to work, because we live about 45 minutes out.
Almost knock-off time?
No, we're just going to finish off this whole tunnel.
It could be. It's nearly lunchtime, but it could be knock-off. It's getting a bit hot.
She's guessing. We're going to finish the tunnel.
I like coming back in. I get the new music.
Oh,
horticultural people say, well, how are you getting the labour for this? And we don't advertise through normal public means or seek. We just go out through our hapu pages, our iwi pages, and then all their nannies and kuros ring them up and go, you get down there and you start working. And they love coming here and working together as a whānau. So that's kind of, that's more important to them actually than what the pay rate is today. That they come to a place where they can be Māori, it's a Māori kaupapa, it's over their land, or it's important that they're close to home. They don't want to have to travel for work. And so the thing I love about coming down here and picking on a Saturday is you're in there with three generations and the young ones are cracking jokes and being rebels and the aunties are yelling at them to pick faster. And, you know, it's all the vibe of a vibrant Māori community.
Liz says the goal is to help those who are keen gain the qualifications they need to drive the businesses.
So people, non-Māori who come to us, like our, like Ryan, our orchard manager, our technical manager, who's come from South Africa because he's one of the best growers of these kind of berries in the world, they know that part of their KPI or their job is to grow a replacement, a Māori replacement for themselves.
I did read where you want to emulate Zespri. You want to be a big player.
Baby Zespri. So when we say that, we sort of just mean the model of working together, helping our growers get the capital that they need on board, and just working collectively as Māori to scale.
You've got some pretty big names on your board.
We do. We're very, very fortunate with our board. We've got terrific capability across the spectrum of horticulture, finance, investment banking, and iwi and Māori economic development. And because we're really a startup, they lean in really hard with us, helping the management team. We've got a very lean management team every single day to navigate the challenges that every startup has. So where's the money coming from? Where's the land coming from? Where's the labour coming from? How do we get the best technical and operational expertise we can to grow these berries really well?
In 10 years' time, what do you hope Miro will look like?
Gosh, it's more about what Māori landowners will look like and rural communities and our people will look like. And so we'll measure success by how much land did we bring into high-value horticulture, how many jobs did we create, and then, you know, the economists can do the numbers on what did that mean to those households and that in those communities, the GDP in those communities, because that's the real driver of how do you lift some of the poorest communities and households in the country, how to give people skills while you do that, because our aspiration is that Māori actually comes back to their roots of being great kaitiaki of the land and the whenua feeding our people, and that they learn to be growers again. But they learn to be growers in a modern context, that they actually own the developments over their own land. And, you know, in 10 years' time, metal won't be in some of those pictures because they'll be big enough, strong enough to do it themselves. So that'll be the measure of success. Kia ora, Perry.
Hello.
These two are superstars. This is Tami Hana and Perry. First employee, Perry, one of the first employees.
Oh, yeah, really? Yeah.
I grew up in Auckland, but I can whakapapa back to Tawhakai and Tuhoe. But in saying that, I only moved back probably about 2013. I was in Opotiki and now I live in Kawaru. Yeah, it's pretty cool though, because I come through the gate and I was super impressed. They were just in the beginning of building, and I was stoked to see such modern facilities. Yeah, I knew that if I could get a job here, I'd learn something pretty amazing about plants and how to grow and culture and orchard.
Tami Hana, where are you from?
I'm from Te Tiko, just down the road. Yeah, I whakapapa to Ngāti Awa and Ngāti Kuri, so from the far north as well, where we've got another orchard.
Oh, another blueberry orchard going in. Oh, okay, would you be prepared to go and work there as well?
No, it's too far. No, that's right at the top. I'm good. So before this, I was studying. So I was looking at welding, and just before that, I was in the catering business.
How does this compare?
I like the outdoors much better. So being out in the open, able to work with a whole bunch of different people.
What have I stopped you doing?
So I was with Perry doing the weeds around the bottom of the pots. So we're just trying to keep them down and get them sorted for next season.
You and your career here, what would you like to see happen?
I'd like to see a lot more of the family in here. Yeah, so a lot more of the locals and, yeah, just get all them, all of our family into jobs where they can thrive.
Tamahana Subritsky at Mehana Kawata Trust's Blueberry Orchard at Te Teko. You also heard from Ebony Paul, Perry Jackson, Ivy in Nawayata Habib, Tamati Keeper Ratahi, Ryan Donovan and Miro CEO Liz Tiamo. Miro's also growing some New Zealand blueberry varieties, which ripen later than Eureka blueberries. They'll allow Miro to supply the market longer and keep people on the payroll.
And that's it for Country Life for another week.
Try not to get too much sun this weekend. Bye now.
Bye.